This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. If you're hiring, with Indeed, you can post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on your short list of qualified candidates using an online dashboard. Get started at Indeed.com/NPR podcast.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Judge Brett Kavanaugh's Supreme Court confirmation hearings begin tomorrow. Things could get quite testy given the politics surrounding the president who picked him. Here's how President Trump announced Kavanaugh's nomination back in July.
Judge Kavanaugh has impeccable credentials, unsurpassed qualifications, and a proven commitment to equal justice under the law.
Now, there is no doubt that Kavanaugh is qualified. He clerked for federal judges, taught at top law schools, he's a former White House attorney, and he sat on the D.C. Circuit Court for 12 years. Regardless of what he says or doesn't say in his confirmation hearings, it is that long paper trail of law review articles and major appellate court decisions that give us a clear window into his judicial thinking. So this hour On Point, a close examination of some of Brett Kavanaugh's past legal decisions in three key areas, national security, abortion, and executive power, and what they might tell us about the kind of Supreme Court justice he could be. You can join us. What do you want to know about Kavanaugh's past rulings on national security, abortion, or executive power? What do you want to know about his career, his judicial philosophy? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Now let's start today with David Savage. He's Supreme Court correspondent for the Los Angeles Times, and he joins us from Washington. David, it's good to have you.
Hi, Meghna.
So, you know, we're going to get into the nitty-gritty of what Kavanaugh has written over the past several years in a second, but I do actually want to start with the politics of this moment, right? Because just at the end of last week, there was this news that the Trump administration is exerting executive privilege and withholding some 100,000 pages of documents from the Senate Judiciary Committee that relate to Kavanaugh. Can you tell us a little bit about sort of where we are now in the run-up to tomorrow's hearings?
Well, the White House had put a guy named Bill Burke in charge of going over these documents. These are documents that are held by the Bush Library, the George W. Bush Library. The idea is Brett Kavanaugh was a lawyer for George W. Bush in 2001 to 2003 and then was a staff secretary. The Democrats wanted to see all those documents. There's quite a long volume. Chuck Grassley, the Judiciary Committee chairman, said, "We'll only seek the 2001 to 2003 documents when he was a White House lawyer." Then they put Bill Burke, who had worked with Kavanaugh in the Bush White House, of sort of going through those and deciding which can be released and which not. And they have constantly sort of whittled that down. They're releasing, a couple hundred thousand pages, which sounds like a lot, but they're also withholding 100,000 or 200,000 in all for various privileges. So nobody really knows exactly why, what was in these documents or why they're being released. But nonetheless, the Democrats are angry that there's a whole lot of documents that are not going to be seen.
Right. So, to that point here, we have some tape of Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar expressing exactly what you're talking about, her frustration about this decision on Meet the Press just yesterday.
This isn't normal. It's not normal because we are not able to see 100,000 documents because the administration has said we can't see them. They've exerted their executive power. 148,000 documents that I've seen that you cannot see because they won't allow us to make them public.
Okay, David, two quick things. First of all, fact check that for us. I mean, the Democrats are claiming this is unprecedented. Is it?
Well, I don't know of any broad issue order like this in the past where large numbers of documents were withheld based on some privilege. I always think there's probably something about some things that would be personal, where you're talking about the president, and it would be sort of embarrassing to somebody if that discussion or, you know, something about somebody's past got out. But I don't recall anything like this where there are hundreds of thousands of pages withheld.
Mm. Well, I mean, Burke has said that the documents being withheld, quote, reflect deliberations and candid advice concerning the selection and nomination of judicial candidates, the confidentiality of which is crucial to any president's ability to carry out core constitutional executive functions. So they're basically saying to protect, the functioning of the presidency regarding future appointments. Does that make sense?
It sounds like it's plausible. That sounds like a good reason. we will know in a couple of years. I mean, it's also possible there's something, some embarrassing things that Kavanaugh said or believed that would cause a problem at the hearings. I must say, I'd be surprised if there was some, you know, so-called smoking gun that he said something or did something that would sort of blow up the hearings. But I suspect there are a number of statements or emails or something that could be embarrassing or troubling in a hearing.
Yeah. You know, Amy Klobuchar, we just heard her say that, or Senator Klobuchar, I should say, say that 148,000 documents will not be seen by the public. But on the other hand, Burke has said that he has produced more than 400,000 pages of records to the Senate Judiciary Committee. And just this gets so political and so complicated, David, because just as an aside, Burke is also lawyer to White House counsel Donald McGahn, right?
That's true. It's one of my editors said, that's not the same Bill Burke, is it? I said, yes, that is the same Bill Burke. They'd read about McGahn's lawyer and read about this person, and somebody thought, oh, this couldn't be the same individual. It is the same individual. So it's quite an unusual situation. He's not working for the Trump White House. He's a private lawyer, but he's doing two different jobs. He's a lawyer for Don McGahn, a personal lawyer, and he was also chosen by the Bush White House and the library to superintend the screening of these documents.
Yeah. So I'm going to welcome a couple more voices into this conversation here in just a second, David. But give us your sense. I mean, you've watched so many confirmation hearings for Supreme Court nominees. Is this one more political than usual, or is it? Have we sort of just become used to lots of tensions between between parties and the, you know, when between the party that isn't in power versus the nominee that the president picks?
Oh, I think it may be slightly more political than usual. They've always been political fights. It's just that Congress, like the rest of the country, seems more sharply divided along party lines. There's fewer people in the middle. It seems to me there'll be a hearing this week, and regardless of what happens, you'd have to bet at the end of this week or whenever they vote, Brett Kavanaugh will be approved on an 11-10 vote. There are 11 Republicans, 10 Democrats, and it's hard to see anybody switching on any side. So this is more political than before, but it's been sort of a gradual each nomination, each decade, it seems, things get slightly more political.
Well, you're listening to David Savage. He's Supreme Court correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. And David, let me just bring in a couple more voices, some very wise legal minds into this conversation. Joining me now is Nancy Gertner. She is a retired federal judge who was appointed by President Bill Clinton. She's also a lecturer at Harvard Law School. Judge Gertner, welcome to On Point.
Good to be here.
Also with us from Atlantic City, New Jersey today is Ronald Cass. He's Dean Emeritus of the Boston University School of Law, former chairman of the Federalist Society's Administrative Law Practice Group, and president of Cass & Associates, a legal consulting firm. He was also a very close friend of the late Antonin Scalia. Ronald Cass, Dean Cass, welcome to you.
Always good to be with you.
It's great to have both of you. We're going to really, for the rest of this hour, dive into, with some detail, into the legal decisions and writings of Brett Kavanaugh. And I'm really excited to do that with all three of you here. But since we are talking about sort of the politics of this moment, Judge Gertner and Dean Cass, let me just start with you, get your first thoughts on that. I mean, Dean Cass, do you think that, I mean, how unusual is it? Is it consequential that these, you know, 100,000, 140,000 pages worth of documents are being withheld from the Senate Judiciary Committee?
Well, you have to realize that Brett served as both a member of the legal counsel's office, which provides advice to the president on legal matters, and just as attorneys and clients often want to have candid discussions, and there are privileges that attach to that. The same is true in that office. And serving as staff secretary for the White House, he was in charge of paper flow. So there are an awful lot of documents that went through his office that really there's nothing about him we're going to learn from them. I think what is really unusual here is the amount of information that's already out there about him, the amount of documents that people can look at. And I don't think that there's anything that people have to worry is being hidden from them. It really is a matter of making sure that the government operates the way it always has.
Nancy Gertner, what's your take on that? Because it seems as if the Trump administration is worrying. That's why they're withholding these documents.
Well, it's an interesting problem. On the one hand, many judicial nominees get to the Congress without a record that anyone can easily peruse. And then the pressure is on questioning them to see what their opinions are. Dean Kass is quite right. Kavanaugh comes to the table with a very substantial record. In his own writings, he says that there ought to be a searching review of judicial candidates precisely because they're life tenured positions. They don't just their term doesn't coincide with the president's. So it's unusual because there's much more here than you usually have, which makes you want to read more. But on the other hand, this is supposed to be a searching review. I agree with the dean that there is quite a lot to deal with. This is a candidate who has telescoped his opinions. I mean, his opinions with a small O, you know, his opinions
right.
about all sorts of issues in law review articles and statements.
Right. So, David Savage, before we head into the break here, just one more question on sort of this political moment. I don't recall the Obama administration, for example, exerting that same executive privilege over documents that relating to Elena Kagan, and she was Solicitor General, right, for the Obama administration. I mean, is that an analogous situation here?
You know, I don't know that they actually did turn over a lot of documents when she was Solicitor General. There's sort of a privilege there that they usually hold on to documents. They did turn over all her documents at the time she was in the White House. So that's the comparison. She wasn't as important. She wasn't there as long, but they did turn over all those documents.
Okay. Well, we're going to dive into a break here. And then when we come back, we will take a fine-tooth comb to some of Brett Kavanaugh's most interesting legal decisions, his law review papers, and what that might illuminate regarding his judicial philosophy on abortion, on executive power, on national security. I'm joined today by David Savage, Supreme Court correspondent for the LA Times, by Judge Nancy Gertner, she's a retired federal judge and lecturer at Harvard Law School, and by Dean Ronald Kass, he's Dean Emeritus at the Boston University School of Law and former chairman of the Federalist Society's Administrative Law Practice Group. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
This message comes from On Point sponsor, Union of Concerned Scientists, creators of Got Science, a biweekly podcast where scientists break down why science matters to all of us. Got Science explores innovations in clean technology and climate solutions, the challenges of missile defense, and how science is critical to strengthening our democracy. Tune in on your favorite podcast app or at gotsciencepodcast.org.
Hey, Tamara.
Hey, Domenico. All week long, Brett Kavanaugh will face his Senate confirmation hearings.
Yeah, he's President Trump's nominee for the Supreme Court, and there are going to be a lot of questions about how he could transform the Supreme Court for a generation.
The NPR Politics podcast will be following those hearings, and we'll hop in the studio every day to break down what you need to know.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking about Judge Brett Kavanaugh's legal career and what his writings, whether it be from decisions he's made on the D.C. Circuit Court or law review articles or speeches he's given, what that tells us about the kind of judicial philosophy he may bring to the Supreme Court if confirmed. His confirmation hearings kick off tomorrow. We're joined today by David Savage. He's Supreme Court correspondent for the L.A. Times. Also by Dean Ronald Kass. He's Dean Emeritus of the BU Boston University School of Law. And also he's former chairman of the Federalist Society's Administrative Law Practice Group. And also we're joined today by Judge Nancy Gertner, retired federal judge and lecturer at Harvard Law School. Now, I want to play a little bit of tape here. This is from March 2016, at an event at the American Enterprise Institute. And Kavanaugh was asked about, the tradition of honoring precedents among courts. And then he's asked another question, and his answer is quite telling.
Can you think of a case deserves to be overturned?
Yes.
Would you volunteer one?
No.
Actually, I'm going to say one. Morrison v. Olson. It's been effectively overruled, but I would put the final nail in.
That's Brett Kavanaugh, March 2016. Morrison v. Olson, by the way, is the 1988 Supreme Court case that established the constitutionality of the Independent Counsel Act. And that's where we're going to start, because it has to do with executive power and executive privilege. Now, it's interesting because, of course, back in the late 90s, Brett Kavanaugh was part of the investigative team with Kenneth Starr, who investigated President Bill Clinton. Now, as lots of folks might know, in 2009, Brett Kavanaugh wrote a really interesting Minnesota Law Review article called Separation of Powers During the 44th Presidency and Beyond. Now, these aren't, you know, this isn't a legal analysis. It's sort of more along the lines of policy recommendations. But in this Minnesota Law Review article, Kavanaugh recommends, quote, that while a president is in office, he should not be subject to civil lawsuits or to criminal investigation or to prosecution. And we're going to talk about why. But first of all, Judge Nancy Gertner, let me start with you. What do you make of this? I mean, in 2009, he says presidents shouldn't be subject to civil lawsuits or to criminal investigation or prosecution while in office. But of course, in the late 90s, he was part of exactly that for the Clinton administration. Your view on what this says about his philosophy?
Well, let me say there's something ironic about the position that he's taking now, which is that he was a very aggressive interlocutor of President Clinton during the Starr investigation. And then in the Minnesota Law Review article agrees that that was a mistake. The Minnesota Law Review article is a policy prescription. Let Congress stop these kinds of investigations, because the office of the presidency is a, you know, takes a lot of time, and you shouldn't be distracted. But there is a lurking quote in this. I love to look for lurking quotes. It says, "No single prosecutor, judge, or jury should be able to accomplish what the Constitution assigns to Congress." That is to say, the impeachment power. So there's a line there that suggests that he believes that if Congress doesn't act, he could take the position that there can be no criminal, that the Constitution forbades any kind of criminal prosecution of the president. No single prosecutor, judge, or jury should be able to do what only Congress can do. Let me also make just another minor point about precedent and that wonderful comment you just heard him say. In his decisions over and over again, he talks about vertical stare decisis, vertical precedent. And that's a thing in the law. But what that means is a court of appeals judge is saying that I am bound by the Supreme Court because it is the court above me. It is not necessarily saying precedent is important wherever it comes from. But I, as a court of appeals judge, I'm bound by the court above me.
But that seems totally normal.
It's totally normal, but it's a very interesting he doesn't talk about precedent as a good in and of itself. He's talking about vertical precedent. I'm bound by the court, by the Supreme Court, implying that, of course, when I get there, things will be different.
So I want to get back to this point when we talk about abortion specifically, because that seems really relevant there. But Dean Ronald Cass, let me turn to you about this issue of executive power and Kavanaugh's view of not investigating or prosecuting presidents while they're in office. It does seem to me, actually, that Brett Kavanaugh has been consistent on this. I mean, we're looking at this Minnesota Law Review article from 2009, but I'm seeing back in 1988, in February of 1988, he actually, you know, said something similar at a Georgetown University panel, right? That he said that there is this lurking constitutional issue that Congress or an independent counsel, whether it should be Congress or an independent counsel, who can investigate the president. And he also later did not recommend that the Starr Commission or that Kenneth Starr charge the president if Congress failed to do so. So he's been consistent.
Yeah, Brett has been consistent in this, and he has really focused on a point in his comment in the late 90s that Justice Breyer had picked up on in a case against Bill Clinton before the Supreme Court. You remember that what got Bill Clinton in a lot of trouble was his answers to questions under oath in a civil suit. When the Supreme Court allowed the civil suit to go forward, one of the things that the court said is that this would not interfere with the conduct of the presidency. Justice Breyer said, well, we ought to be really careful here. I'm going to go along with this, but I'm not so sure that it won't interfere, and we ought to really be watching out for that. What Brett was saying is we can now see that these suits do interfere. Prior to Bill Clinton, there hadn't been a lawsuit allowed against a sitting president on a personal basis while in office. And I think we also have a reason to credit his answer respecting Morrison v. Olson, because one of the issues in Morrison was whether the independent counsel was a principal or an inferior officer, and the court has later adopted a test for that that was proposed by Justice Scalia in Morrison and rejected by the rest of the court there. That later became the majority's rule. So I think he's right on both of those points, and indeed has been very consistent over time.
Yeah. Judge Gertner, I'm going to come back to you, but David Savage, I mean, the reason why so many people are taking a look at this Minnesota Law Review article now and looking for how Kavanaugh might view the effect of an investigation on a president, of course, is because if he is elevated to the Supreme Court, there's the possibility that they may have to take up this issue regarding President Trump. So what's your view on his past writings?
Well, let's go back to Morrison versus Olson, which he said should be overturned. In other words, he took the Scalia position. And Justice Scalia's position was, he had this line that says, the Constitution vests the executive power in the president, and it vests all the power, not just some of it, all of it. So Scalia's view was, is the independent counsel was unconstitutional because it set up a special investigator, special prosecutor, who was not under the control of the president. And Brett Kavanaugh has been a supporter of the so-called unitary executive theory. That is, all the executive power is in the hands of the president to fire people who, you know, and that's been his consistent view. Well, fast forward to today and or that Minnesota Law Review article in 2009, he said these special prosecutors should not be investigating presidents. They should not try to question them. That's something for the impeachment power of Congress. So if there now comes forward a case where Robert Mueller tries to subpoena Donald Trump, and that case comes to the Supreme Court, it seems to me Brett Kavanaugh has pretty much told us his view of this, that he thinks the president has all the executive power. And somebody like Mueller, I think he would think the president is entitled to fire Mueller, and he is certainly entitled to refuse to answer questions from an investigator who's, remember, he's exerting executive power.
Yeah.
But Brett Kavanaugh has always taken the view that the president decides that, not a special prosecutor.
So Judge Gertner, respond to that.
Well, I think that this is sort of consistent, and Dean Kass can speak to this with his view about independent agencies in general. But I think it's important to spin out more of what David was just saying. So it has implications for Bob Mueller's investigation and the very legitimacy of Mueller's investigation. Bear in mind that Mueller actually has less power under the regulations than did Ken Starr
or
Jaworski. Right. So he's dealing with an entity that actually has less power. So it'll have implications for the legitimacy of the report. It'll have implications for the implications of any report that comes out of Mueller's shop. It'll have implications for the subpoena, any subpoenas that will come up. I mean, essentially what Judge Kavanaugh is saying is that it's an either-or situation. You have the president acts and only Congress can impeach, and all other entities that wish to intervene in that can't intervene while the president is still sitting,
yeah,
which has substantial implications for Mueller.
And let's underscore the point of while the president is still
while the
sitting,
president
right?
Is still sitting.
I don't see anything in Kavanaugh's writing that said that would extend beyond the time that the
no.
person was in office.
And he does say that if something happens during the course of the presidency that suggests there should be intervention, that intervention is a congressional intervention, an impeachment intervention, not anything short of that.
Dean Ron Kass, let me get your view here on this, because it does seem that consistently, I mean, we're focusing on executive power right now, but but across a number of areas of the law, that there's this pattern here that Brett Kavanaugh looks to Congress to be the first actor before other sort of independent sources surrounding Congress or the president. I mean, is that a fair assessment of sort of his judicial philosophy?
Well, there are two things that really are key. One is the question of where the locus of executive power is. The Constitution says the executive power is vested in a president of the United States. It doesn't say in a president and other people, along with a president. It just says in a president of the United States. And you have a lot of people who, including people who are really not easily categorized as conservative, like Akhil Amar, a very well-known Yale law professor, who has taken the view that the Constitution is clear from start to finish, that it intends to personally repose power of the executive branch in the president. The other thing is the question of what that means in terms of specific investigations, specific looking at what the president does. And I think the way Judge Gertner described it is the traditional understanding prior to 1974 that really it's up to Congress to decide if it wants to investigate the president, if it wants to impeach the president. That's a congressional power, and that the sort of processes that are ordinary civil and criminal processes of the courts always were thought to be things that could only happen afterwards, not during a presidency. So I think that what Brett has expressed here is pretty much consistent with what has long been the dominant view, although there have been some arguments about it over the last couple of decades.
Well, let's get a quick call here. Ricky's calling from Baton Rouge, Louisiana. You're on the air, Ricky.
Hey, how's it going? How are you doing, Magnus?
I'm doing well. What's your thought for today?
I heard a gentleman, I don't know his name. He sounds like he's on a phone line. And he was saying how, you know, it's Brett Kavanaugh's view that it should be up to Congress and not necessarily an independent counsel. And it should be, you know, a political proceeding, not necessarily a legal one. And that's really dangerous, in my opinion. I mean, look at what happened in the House. The House investigation of Donald Trump was a complete sham. It was a total sham. You know, any leads that they had were shot down by Devin Nunes and co. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that Donald Trump, I mean, it seems like he is pushing for Brett Kavanaugh because of this.
Right.
I mean, I don't want to say that's for sure the reason. I mean, he's a conservative, and look, I'm not necessarily very conservative, but I understand, you know, nominating a conservative Supreme Court justice. But how can people be so okay with the idea that the president is above the law?
Ricky, thank you so much for your call. And that gentleman you're referring to was Ronald Cass, Dean Emeritus of the Boston University School of Law. And so, Dean Cass, let me allow you to respond to that. I think Ricky's bringing up a point which a lot of people might feel, that if investigative power were left solely to Congress and we didn't have, special counsels in the picture, then it could be subject to the very sort of political problems that Ricky was pointing out he saw on the House side of the investigations before Robert Mueller was appointed. I mean, is that not a valid concern?
Well, Ricky is right to be concerned that no one is above the law. And the president is not above the law. No one has ever said he is. But the president is someone who has a very, very important and difficult job to do. And you don't want that job to be interfered with too easily. And again, we go back to the point that Justice Breyer made in his concurrence in the Clinton case back in the 1990s, that you do have to worry about having people who interfere with the president's ongoing duties. Certainly, when Congress acts, there are political forces at play. But there are also political forces at play and other things that come into the decisions of individual officials. So I think that he's right to be worried. He's got his worry a little misplaced in terms of how it plays out with the Constitution and the powers of Congress and the executive.
David Savage, let me just come back to you before we have to take a quick break here. I'm looking at, again, Brett Kavanaugh's 2009 Minnesota Law Review article and, you know, to Ron Cass's point. Kavanaugh wrote, you know, looking back on his time as a member of the investigative team with Kenneth Starr, he said that, quote, the nation certainly would have been better off if President Clinton could have focused on Osama bin Laden without being distracted by the Paula Jones sexual harassment case and its criminal investigation offshoots. That's what Kavanaugh wrote in 2009. But David, we've got a minute to go before the break here. In your own reporting, though, you've spoken with some lawyers who say that if you look at the sections of the Starr report that Kavanaugh himself wrote, that might actually provide a pretty good blueprint of how Robert Mueller might move forward in terms of perhaps constructing a case for obstruction of justice regarding President Trump.
It is an interesting historical coincidence. It was 20 years ago this week, Brett Kavanaugh filed a 132-page memo for the Starr staff, sort of drawing up the legal basis for impeaching President Clinton. They had a relatively small crime alleged. You know, he lied in a deposition about sex with Monica Lewinsky. But then Kavanaugh sort of spun out of view that there's a very broad pattern of obstruction of justice for things like, for example, he didn't testify before the grand jury for 7 months. That was one of the grounds for impeachment that they sent up to the House on March 9th. So Kavanaugh had a very broad view of what can be obstruction of justice and what's an impeachable offense. And if you read that, you think, my goodness, that sounds pretty similar to where we are today.
Well, we are taking a look at Brett Kavanaugh's legal writings and his legal career and what his decisions and law review articles may tell us about the kind of Supreme Court justice he could be. I am joined today by David Savage, Supreme Court correspondent for the LA Times, by Judge Nancy Gertner, she's a retired federal judge and lecturer at Harvard Law School, and by Dean Ronald Cass, he's Dean Emeritus at the Boston University School of Law and former chairman of the Federalist Society's Administrative Law Practice Group. We'll be right back with a lot more. We'll take a look at abortion and national security. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
As soon as you wake up, you need the latest. That's why Up First is here. It's NPR's morning news podcast. In just 10 minutes or so, you can start your day informed. Listen to Up First on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about Judge Brett Kavanaugh's legal writings and his past decisions, especially on the D.C. Circuit Court, and what that might tell us about the kind of Supreme Court justice he could be. We're joined today by David Savage, Supreme Court correspondent for the L.A. Times, by Judge Nancy Gertner. She's a retired federal judge and lecturer at Harvard Law School, and by Dean Ronald Cass. He's Dean Emeritus at the Boston University School of Law and former chairman of the Federalist Society's Administrative Law Practice Group. All right. So I'd like to actually talk about abortion now, because obviously the future of Roe v. Wade is a very contentious point in America. And in 2006, during his D.C. Circuit Court confirmation hearings, then Democratic Senator Chuck Schumer asked Brett Kavanaugh whether he views Roe v. Wade as, quote, an abomination. And Kavanaugh refused to give his personal opinion on the matter.
And I'm saying if I were confirmed to the D.C. Circuit Senator, I would follow it. It's been reaffirmed many times, including in Planned Parenthood versus.
I understand, but what is your opinion? You're not on the bench yet. You've talked about these issues in the past to other people, I'm sure.
The Supreme Court has held repeatedly, Senator, and I don't think it would be appropriate for me to give a personal view on that case.
Not going to answer the question.
So that's Brett Kavanaugh in 2006. But, you know, we know that Kavanaugh has actually issued one I'm thinking about, really interesting ruling regarding abortion while he was on the D.C. Circuit Court. I mean, he is on the court right now. And Judge Nancy Gertner, that's Garza versus Hargan, which concerned a 17-year-old undocumented immigrant and her attempt to have an abortion while in government custody. Now, Judge Kavanaugh, in his ruling, basically issued a ruling that said, I'm summarizing here for people who don't know it, that the Office of Refugee Resettlement, which handles the care of unaccompanied minors in federal custody, did not have to let this 17-year-old obtain an abortion, assuming that she could find a sponsor, right? And that's a family member or other guardian. And here's the key thing, that the delay to find that sponsor wouldn't unduly burden the minor's right to the procedure. Unduly burden is the part that I'm looking at. So what does that tell us about what Brett Kavanaugh sees for abortion rights?
Well, you have to unpack the facts of that for just a second, right? This is an undocumented minor who went through the Texas courts to determine whether or not she was mature enough to make the decision on her own. The Texas courts say she's mature enough to make the decision on her own. The guardian in that case said, I'll pay for the abortion. I'll drive her to the abortion. I'll take her there. And she wants to have it. So the court as a whole said that asking for her to get a sponsor, which especially a sponsor, by the way, who could not contravene her decision to have an abortion, was simply delaying the process for no purpose. And Dahlia Lithwick had a wonderful way of describing it. She said, if essentially holding a pregnant teen migrant until it's too late for her to lawfully terminate her pregnancy isn't an undue burden on a burden on abortion, it's hard to know what is. In other words, the notion that there was no legal reason whatsoever to require her to wait for a sponsor when the guardian that had been appointed for her said, I'll pay for it, I'll take her there, and when she had been determined mature enough to make the decision her own. It says something about how he weighs these things.
Can I just jump in here, though? Because later on in the sort of life of this case, he also wrote, Kavanaugh wrote, that the Supreme Court's many precedents hold that the government has permissible interest in favoring fetal life, and that the Supreme Court has repeatedly held that the government may further those interests so long as it doesn't impose an undue burden
on a
woman seeking an abortion.
But, I mean, it says something quite dramatic as to what is an undue burden. And when you couple that with statements that he made supporting Rehnquist's dissent in Roe v. Wade, and that's very interesting because he said, you know, Rehnquist said there are too many unenumerated rights in that we're following the Constitution. If it's not in the Constitution, we can't enforce it. Kavanaugh says, well, he believes that there are certainly rights that are not explicitly stated in the Constitution, but those have to be rights that are consistent with our traditions. And since abortion didn't exist lawfully in the 18th century, it's not consistent with our traditions. Well, the whole skein of privacy rights, the right to contraception, the right to marry whomever you want, gay marriage, that whole skein did not exist in the 18th century.
So, Dean Ronald Cass, let me turn to you on this, but just to elaborate on something that Judge Gertner just said. At a speech at the American Enterprise Institute last September, I believe, Brett Kavanaugh said exactly this. He said a lot of very interesting things about the career of former Justice William Rehnquist, but one part which I just want to reiterate, he stated that under the court's precedence, any such unenumerated right had to be rooted in the traditions and conscience of our people. So tell me, how do you think that might lead him to, you know, what view he might take if Roe or a challenge to Roe does come back before the Supreme Court?
Well, for one thing, you know, it's important to note that only one member of the court that's sitting right now has said he would vote to overturn Roe v. Wade. A lot of people who think it was not a well-reasoned decision have still said that they think it is now part of the settled fabric of the law, and they would uphold it. And really have embraced the case against Planned Parenthood framework. I don't see anything that Judge Kavanaugh has said that's inconsistent with that. I do think that, you know, one thing that Judge Gertner's comment on Garza v. Hargan, you know, when Brett said that it was consistent with precedent to require the appointment of a sponsor, he also, in his opinion there, said, but while that will not unduly burden the right of the minor in that case if undertaken expeditiously. If it's not undertaken expeditiously, we may have to come back and then enforce the right to allow her to have an abortion. So he was not taking an extreme position there. He did take a position that was not the majority position on the circuit, but it certainly is one embraced by a number of other judges, and he was relying on precedent to do that.
So Judge Gertner, did you want to...
I just think we should be very, you know, sort of careful in how far we go with these.
Well, I mean, I think the question of whether or not she needed to get a sponsor and the amount of time that it would take had been litigated in the case. And it was clear that during the entire pendency of this case, the government had not been able to come up with a sponsor. But the more significant issue is that the sponsor was irrelevant to her decision to have an abortion, because as a mature minor, she could make that decision. So what he was doing was interposing a requirement, putting on a requirement that was plainly interfering with her right to choose. I might add that by the time this case got to the D.C. Circuit, she was on the cusp of the second trimester. So it was really, in my view, with all respect, a very craven requirement to say, wait some more for this additional hoop that absolutely she didn't have to do.
David Savage, let me turn to you here for a second, because as some folks may know, Maine Senator Susan Collins said that Brett Kavanaugh did tell her that he considered Roe, quote, settled law. But on the other hand, I mean, this debate over undue burden and Kavanaugh's view of what constitutes or doesn't constitute an undue burden. I wonder if in the Garza case, if he's basically saying that his view of what an undue burden is or what does not constitute undue burden is so broad that Roe doesn't even really matter, that he perhaps might look favorably upon other kinds of cases that continue to challenge the availability of abortions or the circumstances under which women can get them.
Yes, you're suggesting that no burden would be undue in his you know, you mentioned Susan Collins. The same day, he also met with Schumer, Chuck Schumer, and he said after the he told reporters afterwards that he asked Kavanaugh, would it be an undue burden to no abortions after 6 weeks of a pregnancy or no abortions after 4 weeks? And Schumer said he would not answer that question. So if there's no right to abortion that goes up beyond 4 or 6 weeks, then really it's sort of a silly semantic game, because then the state really can ban abortions, and there's no right of the woman to go ahead and end the pregnancy.
Mm. Well, it's good.
If I can jump in, Magnum.
Go ahead.
I think it would be really unwise to assume, because he wouldn't answer a hypothetical question, that his answer would be there would be no undue burden. He's been very clear in his writing, you know, and again, you know, in the Garza case, he does say, if it can't be done expeditiously, we will have to come back and say what the answer is in this. We may have to just enter the order. So I think that a lot is being extracted from very little here, and mostly what he's saying is, I feel bound by precedent. I'm going to follow him. I'm not going to answer hypotheticals.
But again, he feels bound by precedent at the level that he's at. But that
on
is
the
not
court.
That's right, on the circuit court. But that's not where he would be were he to be any higher. Let me say one other thing. The other interesting thing about the Garza case is that this woman was detained. The issue of the legitimacy of the abortion was not litigated by the government, because prisoners who get pregnant, there are two cures, I hate to put it that way, for pregnancy for a prisoner, either abortion or birth. The government had obligations to a detained person that would be different than even the ordinary person, which makes his position all the more egregious, it seems to me. I think he is telescoping in word and deed, as David was saying, either that he will regard all burdens as sufficient. I might add that when you begin to talk about the right of the fetus with respect to burdens, that actually has been a calculus that has not been in Roe v. Wade before. And there's no end to that.
I want to take one more call here. Kathy is calling from Sarasota, Florida. You're on the air, Kathy.
Hello. I think there is no end to this. This has got to stop. Kavanaugh, I don't know. I don't know. I think he's
Kathy, you still with us? Looks like we've lost Kathy's call. I'm sorry about that, Kathy. Try again. If we got enough time, we'll try and get back to you. I want to just shift gears here slightly and take a step back and listen to something that Brett Kavanaugh said in 2015. This is at a lecture he gave at Catholic University of America's Law School, where he compared good judges to umpires, saying that they've got to understand their role in the game to apply the rules and not remake the rules based on their own policy views. And he also talked about judges displaying humility and modesty.
Chief Justice Roberts referred to being a modest judge in his confirmation hearing. What does that mean? It means a lot of things, I think. A lot is captured under humility and modesty as a judge. First of all, we're not to make the policy ourselves. That's obvious, but we constantly have to remember it's not our job to make the policy choices that belong in the political branches.
That's Brett Kavanaugh in 2015. Dean Ronald Cass, I want to turn to you because we've just got a couple of minutes to go. But I thought that 2015 lecture was really interesting from Brett Kavanaugh because it seems to match what I glean is his view on the number of cases that he's done regarding national security, that he was not willing to make judicial decisions in cases, lots of Guantanamo Bay cases, for example, where he felt really it was Congress or the executive that had the right to do what they chose to do. I mean, just give me your view on his national security cases.
Well, he's been a very cautious judge and a very deferential judge. He has intervened to overturn a decision of the executive branch that he thought violated the law that was settled at the time of the action in Hamdan. At the same time, he has also in other cases said, I'm not going to bring in types of law that haven't been approved by Congress. I'm not going to intervene. I'm not going to set my stamp on this. I'm going to defer to the branches that are tasked with setting the law and implementing the law. And I think that sort of judicial modesty in this area, in the national security area, also is a stamp of his approach to lots of different areas. It's the reason why I so thoroughly disagree with my friend Judge Gertner on her interpretation of what he did in the Garza case as well. So I think across the board, this is a hallmark of him.
But Dean Castle, if I just may follow up on that. I mean, I was looking at the 2008 Supreme Court case, Boumediene versus Bush, and Justice Kennedy wrote the majority opinion there. And he said that, quote, within the Constitution's separation of power structure, few exercises of judicial power are as legitimate or necessary as the responsibility to hear challenges to the authority of the executive to imprison a person. So Justice Kennedy there calling for limits to judicial modesty.
But of course, in Hamdan, that exactly what Brett Kavanaugh did was he overturned a conviction under the Military Commissions Act because he thought it did go too far. He's not saying we don't listen to challenges. He's saying that what we do is we listen to them within a very confined framework that don't let us make up the rules.
Mm. Judge Gertner?
But Hamdan was the exception. In a 2010 case, he talked about the president having unilateral authority to hold Guantanamo detainees indefinitely. The efforts of the Supreme Court to modestly, in my view, carve out rights for people detained even under a national security rationale, with the sole exception of the Hamdan case, which was a statutory interpretation, arguably, he's really taken a different path. And although we don't have time for it on this program, if you look at all the dissents from that he has filed with the D.C. Circuit in discrimination cases, in OSHA cases, interpretations that the rest of the court had not accepted. I don't think he's being modest with respect to his policy prescriptions at all.
Interesting. I mean, there's so many national security cases. I'm looking at Razak Ali versus Obama 2013, where Kavanaugh acknowledged that the United States is engaged in a long war regarding terrorism with, quote, no end in sight, but that it's not the judiciary's proper role to devise new detention standards that vary with the length of detention there. So there's so many national security cases. But David Savage, we just got 30 seconds left to go. We're trying to maybe bite off more than we can chew in this hour. But the confirmation hearings begin tomorrow. What should we expect on day one?
A lot of opening statements. They sort of waste the first day with opening statements. Kavanaugh will speak at the end of the day. The real things will pick up on Wednesday morning when they start the questioning.
Well, David Savage, Supreme Court correspondent for the Los Angeles Times, joining us today from Washington. David, thank you so very much.
Thank you.
And Ronald Cass, Dean Emeritus of the Boston University School of Law, former chairman of the Federalist Society's Administrative Law Practice Group, and president of Cass & Associates. Dean Cass, a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much.
As always.
And Nancy Gertner, retired federal judge appointed by President Bill Clinton and lecturer at Harvard Law School. Judge Gertner, thank you for your insights today.
Thank you.
Keep your comments coming about what you think Brett Kavanaugh might, the questions he might face, or the kind of Supreme Court justice he might be. Send us your comments at onpointradio.org. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.